Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers, coming to you live from southern Mississippi, our IQ window forecast. Just under 100 degrees, humidity to match. Great for trees, bad for people, especially if you're Scottish and can't take hot weather very well like me. There are 4 sunspots active right now on the sun, and sunspot 1247 is growing in an unprecedented way. It is already more than 200,000 kilometers long and growing. Very strange, long shape of a sunspot. A medium-sized coronal mass ejection launched particle and radiation in a glancing blow our way on Friday, which may yet cause auroras. It's kind of moving slow through space, so we don't really know what it's going to do. Probably geomagnetic disturbances, nothing really serious. The solar wind is a little over 450 kilometers per second. You know, the odds of hitting Earth for a coronal mass ejection are slim, as we are a tiny target in space. On Sunday, today, July 10th, for the 12th and final time, Space Shuttle Atlantis docked to the International Space Station. Everything that Atlantis is doing is the final time a space shuttle will do it. The combined crew of 10 now commences more than a week of docked operations, transferring vital supplies and equipment to sustain the International Space Station in the post-shuttle era, carrying the burden of history. That's profound, isn't it? Atlantis pierced the low cloud deck that threatened to scrub this final space shuttle launch, its tail glow lighting a ring beneath the clouds as the craft slipped ever higher. What are we going to do now, many people are asking, but hitch a ride occasionally on a Russian craft or a Chinese craft as we end the era of space shuttle flights launched from America. Kind of interesting. NASA currently has plans to use a new space capsule called the Multi-Purpose Crew Vehicle for future deep space missions. The vehicle is based on work for the agency's Orion spacecraft developed for the previous moon plan. You know, that other moon plan that we scrapped. The heavy lift rocket for the new program is called the Space Launch System, but the details of the booster are not yet final. This week, NASA officials said they plan to settle on a design for the new rocket by the end of the summer. By the way, as we get started tonight, if you want to be part of the program, BBS Radio is constantly upgrading, constantly improving things. It's moving to such high levels of quality that it's difficult for even me to keep up. We now have a toll-free number anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, toll-free. So now you have no reason not to call. That number is 888-260-3070, and we will shortly be adding toll-free for Europe as well. How about that? That's big time, isn't it? Modern global internet talk radio. If you want to listen to the program while you're out and about, not going to have your computer with you, not going to have a internet connection with which to listen to the program, you can do so by dialing 760-569-7676 and then the access code 192-919-pound. You won't be able to talk, but you will be able to hear everything. So you can put your Bluetooth on and wander innocuously through the frozen food section at Walmart while secretly listening to the program. I think it's a wonderful idea. I wanted to cover the space shuttle program just a little bit tonight. I know you've heard a lot about it on the news, but I want to cover it from a little different angle, as we usually do on X Squared Radio. For one thing, there seems to be enough evidence out there that there's a secret space program going on. However, I have to tell you, as I went to put together some evidence for this, the only evidence that I was able to find on the internet was from other conspiracy sites. So it's going to be difficult to put together something credible, you know, for me to represent to you originally. But I would like to play for you Obama's short comments, brilliant as they are, so well put together. I know you're going to be impressed by this. This is the audio from Obama's, President Obama's comments on the last shuttle mission. I just want to share them with you. I think you'll like them.
I have been pushing NASA to revamp its vision. The shuttle did some extraordinary work in low-orbit experiments, this International Space Station, moving cargo. It was an extraordinary accomplishment, and we're very proud of the work that it did. But now what we need is that next technological breakthrough. We're still using the same models for space travel that we used with the Apollo program 30, 40 years ago. And so what we've said is, rather than keep on doing the same thing, let's invest in basic research around new technologies that can get us places faster, allow human spaceflight to last longer, what you're seeing now is NASA, I think, redefining its mission, and we've set a goal to let's ultimately get to Mars. A good pit stop is an asteroid. We haven't identified the actual asteroid yet, in case people are wondering. But the point is, let's start stretching the boundaries so we're not doing the same thing over and over again. But rather, let's start thinking about what's the next horizon, what's the next frontier out there. And, but in order to do that, we're actually going to need some technological breakthroughs that we don't have yet. And what we can do is, for some of this low-orbit stuff, some of the more routine space travel, obviously no space travel is routine, but it could become more routine over time. Let's allow the private sector to get in so that they can, for example, send these low Earth orbit vehicles into space, and we may be able to achieve a point in time where those of you who are just dying to go into space, you know, you can buy a ticket, and a private carrier can potentially take you up there while the government focuses on the big breakthroughs that require much larger investments and involve much greater risk.
I'm sorry. How long was I out? Wow, that was so inspirational. Where was I? Oh, yeah. We were talking about the space shuttle flight. Yeah. How long was I out? I'm really sorry. I mean, should I play that again? No, I think not. Was that the leader of the free world inspiring us about the future glory of space exploration? I must have missed it. Well, we have often talked about the secret space program being conducted by a multinational fund. There's really nothing new on that. I was doing some digging this week trying to find, you know, some evidence, some audio or video somewhere where I could share it with you that wasn't speculation. I think that if we are participating in a secret space program, that it only makes sense to take down the 40-year-old external combustion program that appears to be for entertainment purposes only. Maybe Obama's doing the right thing. I mean, we might as well. Who's going to believe you anymore? I mean, even the president isn't convinced, is he? Didn't sound too convinced to me. Maybe you'd like to share your thoughts on the subject. 888-260-3070. You know, NASA doesn't have a really huge budget. And, you know, the times that that I visited with NASA folks and JPL folks, I have found it mostly populated with young people. Some of them are engineering students. Some of them are grad students, which are low paid, to say the least, trying to get a little bit of a reputation, trying to get some work experience behind them. It's kind of a, I'm not going to say a low budget operation. Some of this stuff takes about $100 million a year to operate. Some of the programs are more than that. We have about 65 active space programs going on right now. Most of the purview for that is turned over to university budgets, and great experience for the students. No issues with that there. But, you know, to say that it has fallen into a routine would be rather an understatement. To say that the press may not have done their job in sensationalizing it enough and, you know, getting people excited about the space program as they were in the 60s, because it was, you know, it was something new back then. It was, we're going to the moon. We have a mission. We're going to get there and get back. And we did. And guess what? In less than, you know, 10 visits, it was old hat. We were done with the moon. We were done, you know, sweeping the dust off of our feet and collecting rocks and exploring our nearest satellite. Or were we? Yeah, interesting. By the way, this last weekend, Transformers 3 came out. My initial review, I saw it a couple times. Yeah, I like watching movies. I'm a good movie reviewer, too. I thought the theme of it was a little more dark than the other two movies. I thought the acting was superb. The CGI was off the charts. I also have to say that the idea behind it, that there was a race to get to the moon in the 60s because some alien technology had been detected striking the moon, and that some of that technology had been recovered not by the Americans but by the Soviet Union. They had made an attempt to use the technology to generate energy, which they got the brilliant idea to tie this into Chernobyl, that was the reason Chernobyl came apart. But I found the theme to be very credible. And it kind of went along with my thoughts that science fiction, especially Michael Bay and Spielberg and these world-class high-budget directors and producers, are sort of preparing us. They're you know, habituating us. They're getting us ready to face the reality of solid alien contact. And I don't know if you've ever written a screenplay. Like, I am an expert in every one. But I can tell you that there's always a struggle getting these films funded. And certainly having a star and yeah, I'm sorry that my internet connection's a little choppy. I'm not really sure what's going on there except the wonderful Comcast. Let's go ahead and bring a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the program. Welcome.
Hello, Dr. Agnew.
How are you, Anton? Welcome.
Hi, it's Antonin Fiore from the Crimson Pill, my friend. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, we're struggling to get it out there, choppy as the internet is in the third world country of Mississippi.
See, I just had a quick thought. I'm extremely excited to hear the remainder of the program. I love the start that it is off to in a topical sense. And I just thought I would offer a quick thought. Just recently, I've done a broadcast talking about NASA, its inauspicious beginnings, the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958 that actually chartered and created NASA. And for a lot of folks out there, I know that they struggle to consider that there might be a secret space program. And it's very easily ascertained right from the beginning of the Title I, Section 102, Declaration of Policy and Purpose, Article B. And I'd be willing to maybe share from that if you have time or interest.
Yeah, I'm interested, of course. Let's hear it.
Well, when I begin reading from Section B, at first it sounds very benign, and then it makes its turn quite rapidly, a quick pivot point. So the first part begins, the Congress declares that the general welfare and security of the United States require that adequate provision be made for aeronautical and space activities. The Congress further declares that such activities shall be the responsibility of and shall be directed by a civilian agency exercising control over aeronautical and space activities sponsored by the United States. Now, this is a comma, not a period, after what I've said thus far. And thus far, it sounds great. That's exactly what we're told through the media and through our textbooks and since what we've been told since the inception of NASA itself. But again, it didn't stop with a period. Now it's a comma, and I continue. Except that activities peculiar to or primarily associated with the development of weapons systems, military operations, or the defense of the United States, parentheses, including the research and development necessary to make effective provision for the defense of the United States, end of parentheses, shall be the responsibility of and shall be directed by the Department of Defense. There it's a semicolon, and it continues with a bit more odds and ends. But that's the first layer of the distinction.
We could just discuss that part right there, because you know that the members of I'm going to say the crew that have actually left this planet in some form or fashion with NASA have all been either Air Force or Navy pilots. It's all been directed by the military. Most of the funding comes from the military. And wherein the defense of the United States or America has in recent years become the offense of America against other countries for the specific purpose of expanding the interests of America.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Quite right. Quite right. And Dr. Agnew, as I finish reading from Section B, just the final part, this tells us definitively that there are, in fact, two agencies. There's the publicly known NASA civilian agency, and then there is the Defense Department space agency. Because as I continue after that semicolon following Department of Defense, and that determination as to which such agency has responsibility for and direction of any such activity shall be made by the President in conformity with Section 201. And there are quite a few other clauses and sections that sew this together, but right from the beginning, Section 102, it's made rather overtly known that there are two agencies. One is Department of Defense, there's that space agency, and then there's the civilian side.
Well, if we try to follow the money, what we find is the NASA budget, the one that's publicized, the one that we discuss from time to time on this program, and then there's the defense budget, which is not publicized and for which we cannot cover the details on this program.
Precisely. That's exactly right. And going more so to your point, in fact, there's that black budget that goes to the Defense Department's secret space agency. There is that black budget money that's funneled that direction. And, of course, we remind ourselves that on September 9th of 2001, Donald Rumsfeld, in a press conference, announced to the public that more than $2 trillion that had been allocated to the Department of Defense were not trackable. Now, that's not to say that it went missing, that a bunch of people had their pockets loaded with it, but by untrackable, it is, in fact, to say that it went black. It went off the record, off the accountable records.
Well, one of the more interesting observations is that this statement was made during a congressional inquiry, which was led by Sheila Jackson Lee.
Ah, yes.
And, you know, not to say anything disparaging about any member of Congress, but not the sharpest knife in the drawer, not the one to be leading a $2 trillion accounting investigation. Nevertheless, at least it got entered into the congressional record that, hey, we know you overdrafted the checking account by a small amount, $2 trillion. Would you mind telling us where the money went? And, of course, Rumsfeld, you know, just barely cracked a smile and said back to Sheila Jackson Lee, we have no idea where it is. We lost it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yes. And, you know, in fact, just in case there's anyone still with any kind of cognitive dissonance about the existence of this black budget Defense Department space program, which is operated discreetly from the civilian agency called NASA. If I forward in again the Space Act of 1958 that chartered NASA, if I forward to Section 206, which is titled Reports to Congress, the first sections, A, B, and C, again, sound quite innocuous. I'll give an example. Section A, the administration, NASA, shall submit to the president for transmittal to the Congress semi-annually and at other such times as it deems desirable, a report of its activities and accomplishments. It sounds like we're talking about transparency, being above board, the right hand knowing what the left hand is doing. But when you get to the end of Section 206, it's Clause D here, or Article D, no information which has been classified for reasons of national security shall be included in any report made under this section, unless such information has been declassified by or pursuant to authorization given by the president. And the trouble here, of course, is that the president and his access to classified information is it's not at the top of the top of the pecking order.
Well, not to mention, we're not talking about sharing the NASA reports with the press here. The act is specifically saying you're not to share the report with Congress.
Precisely. That's precisely right. And, you know, if, for anybody that's still a little bit wondering about how this is possible, they can look at Section 303, which is titled Access to Information. And it says that, again, it begins innocuously the way we would want the historical record to sound. Information obtained or developed by the administrator in the performance of his functions under the Act shall be made available for public inspection except A, information authorized or required by federal statute to be withheld, and we'll come back to that federal statute in just one moment because that's what really locks the door shut, and B, information classified to protect the national security. The following section is Section 304, entitled Security. And when you get to Article C, it states, Chapter 37 of Title 18 of the United States Code. So that speaks back to the federal statute we just referred to. And that chapter of United States Code is entitled Espionage and Censorship, is amended by adding to the end of it, 799, Violation of Regulations of National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which lays out the penalties, both in terms of financial penalties, but also potential imprisonment for anybody who violates those classifications that it has laid out in the Act to this point.
Well, so in other words,
sorry,
you know, it's easy to grab the black highlighter. It's easy to err on the side of blackening out too much rather than too little, because there are penalties. If something related to the defense or something that's classified relative to the Defense Department is somehow inadvertently revealed to Congress.
You're exactly right. For any single researcher, scientist, person involved in these NASA projects, and let's bear in mind once again, the secret Defense Department space agency is the one that's looking at and doing the real stuff. What's held over for NASA is what is intended perhaps to flow for public consumption, and yet all of these statutes are put in place so that any NASA employee, scientist, maybe even the astronaut themselves, if they made an observation, if they held an artifact in their hand, they knew from the moment they touched it or saw it that they would face not only severe financial penalties, being stripped of any potential pensions, also these financial penalties that can be imposed as a result of this act, but they also know they face imprisonment for just merely admitting to or attesting to having seen or experienced this information.
Oh, if it can be related to the defense or the secrecy of the defense of the of America. You know, we have had astronauts recently, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, not the least of which, who have come out publicly and said that that the government knows a lot more than it's telling, that we do have in our possession alien technology, that there was more to the moon than what was originally reported. Does this, you know, violate the defense of America? I doubt it. I mean, you could stretch and say yes, but the fact that we kept the secret is what violates the trust of the American people.
You are precisely correct, and all we have to do is look at the historical example of President Richard Nixon in the Watergate scandal, who himself was all too willing so quickly to try to use that veil, that defense, that tactic of declaring information to be national security when it was so far removed from being that. And when that kind of power is able to be placed in the hands of one single individual, even when it's the President of the United States, it can be difficult to overcome that temptation to wield that magic wand of national security to keep even trivial things hidden, like in the case of Nixon and Watergate, scandals that are just, you know, kind of petty affairs by comparison to some of these things that are of such tremendous significance. And to underscore further what you've said about this, the notion of this defense and the loosely applied conditions of slapping the label national security on things, later in the same Space Act, under Clause I of the longest section that's actually in the Act, ironically, which deals with property rights and inventions, but in Section I, the administration shall be considered a defense agency. It's saying NASA will be considered a defense agency of the United States for the purpose of Chapter 17 of Title 35 of the U.S. Code, which the title of that code, you have to flip and go to over to the U.S. Code for that, but the title of that code is Secrecy of Certain Inventions and Withholding of Patent. Now, what's important here is it's not just the secrecy of invention side. Dr. Agnew, you know very well from your own research and past experience that there are members of our, the United States citizenry that have done research, original research of their own at home in their own workshops and labs, trying to look into, trying to investigate potential sources of free energy, for example, and or other inventions that could make such an impactful difference to our environment, to our economy, to the general welfare of people. And the reason that you hear these stories about folks who come upon some of these inventions or potential solutions that could help, and that you hear about them suddenly disappearing, you hear about their work being confiscated, is precisely this clause of the Act and this section of United States Code. Because this section details precisely how the government has the authority by whichever tools they want, if it's the FBI, CIA, any of the black alphabet agencies, or even through the Defense Department, they have complete license, as spelled out in careful detail in this clause of Chapter 17, to prevent that from coming to surface.
Here's the thing. You can't just have people out there thinking up stuff on their own. I mean, you know, what if they come up with a really good idea that would harm the interests of the United States, its holdings in various companies, GM, or other things? you know, that would somehow devalue the interests of the United States or the government or companies that are great contributors to certain officers of the state. You can't just have somebody invent something that would infringe upon that. Can you? I mean, you got to have the right to go in and, you know, seize the guy's computer and shut him down and make it financially impossible for him to bring his idea to fruition.
Naturally, you're exactly right. For heaven's sake, for someone to invent some kind of alternative fuel combustion that gives us 200 miles to the gallon instead of only 20, that clearly represents a dangerous, dangerous breach of national security. And that has to be snuffed out, instantly.
Well, I don't know. You know, the whole thing is about supply and demand and, about getting small business. We're going to talk a little bit about that in the next hour. I'm going to talk about the science of bringing good ideas to the market. And you bring up a good point, Anton, and I want to revisit something. We visited a couple times in the last couple of years. It's our old friend Peak Oil, you know, that talked about people talk about abiotic oil. That's oil that doesn't come from biological decay. It's somehow generated in the bowels of the earth and pumped up into the reservoirs into which we drop our drill pipes and our pump pipes. There's an article that just came out to Tim Warstall. I mean, gosh, can you have a name like Tim Warstall? Whew. Anyway, he's a Forbes writer for Forbes magazine. He says there is a common and very annoying misunderstanding about peak oil. Well, that just got my attention right away. I had to read his article. One that leads all sorts of people to worry about it a great deal more than they ought to. The government was warned by its own civil servants 2 years ago that there would be significant negative economic consequences to the UK posed by near-term peak oil energy shortages. Ministers were told it was impossible to know exactly when production might fail to meet supply, but when it did, there could be global consequences, including civil unrest. Now, this is really interesting because this is kind of not a play on words. It's really wrong English to say that production might fail to meet supply. What they really mean is that production might fail to meet demand. And that's where it gets into this tricky thing of supply and demand. Now, mind you, Forbes magazine is going to look at this from a financial point of view. So one of the basic things about economics is that there is no such thing as supply or demand. There's only supply at a price and demand at a price. So if supply does fall, then price will rise. That price will change. It'll reduce the demand, and thus supply and demand will balance. Normally, that's correct. That's exactly the way economics works. And if oil prices move from $100 a barrel to, say, $200 a barrel, there will be an awful lot of people still demanding $100 a barrel oil. But so what? The price is now $200, which is where supply and demand balance. Well, you know, there's an awful lot of people, like anyone stuck with a Hummer, who would like $10 a barrel oil. But we don't say that supply and demand don't balance because some would like to have $10 a barrel oil. We just say that, okay, it's now $100 because that's the price where supply and demand balance. That's the way economics works. The problem with Mr. Warstall's oils well that ends well philosophy is that there is an assumption that oil will be available at whatever rate the spigot is opened. There's another wild card or two in this. When certain countries don't get what they want at the price that they want it, they call up Wars R Us and they go take it. by force. That's one wild card. A la Libya, which is going on right now. We don't like that leader, and so we're going to get rid of him. Libya's a big oil producer. And you just saw in the news just this week, amazing piece of history. South Sudan is now declared its independence after a long civil war. But guess what? South Sudan has all the oil. North Sudan doesn't have the oil reserves that South Sudan has. That's why they've been fighting for a decade. They're also the very largest customers who have arbitrarily set the value of their money with which they buy the oil. This is the second wild card. It's a little like making dollar coins out of lead and painting them to look like gold, then going to the market with a Gatling gun slung over your shoulder just in case somebody says something about it, a la China. China has a yuan, which is artificially valued, and with which they buy. They are now the number one buyers of oil in the world, and they don't let their currency float to market values. They assign it a value and make the world accept it at that value. So when you throw in these two wild cards, Mr. Wirstall's formula for supply and demand balance don't work. We reach a point called peak oil. Peak oil means there's not enough oil to fill the pipeline. It means that, and if there was enough oil to fill the pipeline, and we could talk about that a little bit too, about Saudi Arabia's, they're the number one oil exporters, about their production and their real production. We don't have the refining capacity, especially in the United States, to even process greater flows of oil. So where are we with this whole energy balance, national security question you just brought up, Antonin?
You are quite right, and as usual and customary, quite astute with the points that you've made, Dr. Agnew. You're right on target. As a matter of fact, it's the reason why I listen to your show more often than mine, is because I go looking for the truth and I know where the source is. So I appreciate the chance to visit with you on your show, and I certainly don't want to preclude anyone else from having a chance to interact with you as well. So maybe at this point, Dr. Agnew, I should cut my time short just to give a chance for the open lines, and also because I'm curious to keep taking notes as you continue your expedition.
Well, I always appreciate your input, Anton, and you make me think of good questions, and you make the show exciting. I appreciate your call. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, and goodbye.
All right. This whole thing, and by the way, I have to make a comment about President Obama's comments about the space program. You know, in this age of teleprompters and speechwriters and briefers and all that, as you're walking down the hallway getting your 90-second bullet points that you're going to write on the inside of your palm so that you can make a good, quick YouTube speech, I was disappointed in the quality of the president's comments about the end of this era with NASA. You know, back in the days when our best recording device was a 3/8 magnetic tape, Kennedy and Nixon and Johnson and even Carter, Ford, they all made the best quality statements that they could when they were in front of the microphone. This comment that was made very recently, I'm going to say in the last 36 hours, about this final launch of the last space shuttle Atlantis to supply the International Space Station, was vacuous. I mean, I didn't really fall asleep. I mean, I acted like I fell asleep, but I did fall asleep when I listened to it the first time. I had to stay awake because I got to run all these knobs and stuff and act really technical so you get a good quality program tonight. But this is a landmark where a reusable space truck that we've been sending up and back to space, almost all of the quality repair that requires a human presence in space has been done with the space shuttle. And I don't think that these things are going to the scrapyard either. I think they're going back to the garage. They're being polished up, refitted with the latest stuff, and they're being parked. Because, mark my words, something is going to happen where we need to deploy 10 or 12 human technicians, experts, scientists, engineers, astronauts into space. And we'll be dragging these shuttles back out, filling them back up with hydrogen peroxide and getting them back up into space. It is the end of an era as far as regular scheduled space shuttle flights, but I don't think it's the end of the space shuttles. Far too useful. Airframes can be eternal. If you don't believe me, take a public flight sometime in an MD-80 or an old 737. You'll see those airframes will go thousands and thousands and thousands of hours in the air, because they can constantly be refurbished. Airframes are eternal. One more piece of aluminum, one more piece of titanium. There you go. The A checks all the way to D checks. Once an airplane gets a D check, it's pretty much refitted and ready to go just as though it was new. In a lot of cases, many of the systems, hydraulics, electronic redundancies are upgraded, and it's an even better aircraft than it was when it was built. So I don't see an end of the space shuttle forever. I do see that we will probably, most likely, have an event where we need to have them back up into space. And that's why I was so disappointed in what the president had to say. I have lived in many states where, for instance, military bases have been closed. At first, the local town says, oh my goodness, what are we going to do without the base? What are we going to do without those military paychecks being spent in our grocery stores and our bars and whatever? What are we going to do without that money? But in every single case, when the military leaves that facility, by and large, there's always some presence still there, National Guard or something. Those buildings, that real estate has been reoccupied by business that uses an airport. Some of them are like interior aircraft refurbishers or specialty machine shops that need expedited freight, or even expedited freight companies. And in almost every case, more jobs were created after the military base left than there were when the military base was active. And better paying jobs, because that real estate is transferred into the ownership of the municipality. It adds value to the community and things take off. So it's never the end of the world when these military bases are deactivated, especially domestically. So that's one of the reasons why I was so disappointed in the president's comments, because this might be the end of an era for the space shuttle. And it might be an opportunity to, you know, lay off those people that were involved in that program. But it is an opportunity to take advantage of the great technology, the great lessons, the great routines, the great safety routines and procedures that we have learned, hopefully not through sad experience, but through successful experience. And we're able to build a better space program. We're able to take a space program and weave it into private industry, just like we do those military bases in communities all across America that have been demilitarized over the decades. We now have a program by which we can put a commercial platform into space. Now, Antonin brought up a good point. Most of the money, most of the drive, most of the justification for space travel, for space activity, for space investment, has been in the name of national defense. It is without question, inarguably a case that he who controls space controls the world. There is no question about this. Having a superior footprint in space with respect to surveillance, with respect to defensive and even offensive weaponry, although I don't like to see space weaponized, it is unavoidable, given the bad boys that we have running around without uniforms, without pride, without courage on our country and on our world right now, doing dastardly things to themselves and others. You know, we have to have a way to watch them. We have to have a way to stop them, even if it means drilling a laser hole in the top of their skull before they ever get started. You got to have something out there to take care of one or two people so that we don't lose thousands. But that's done. That's in place. Now we have a platform by which commercial entities can get going in space. We could take advantage of low-gravity manufacturing. We can take advantage of long-term, high-intensity solar power in space. We have a fairly low-gravity satellite 250,000 miles away. That's nothing. That's like flying from Florida to California. Is it routine? Well, not exactly. We still have to lift, you know, multiple thousands of pounds into the air and make it fly safely. I mean, behind the cabin or the cockpit door, it looks pretty routine. You know, we get our Coke, we get our peanuts, we have our seatbelts, we watch our in-flight movie. It's pretty routine. But in front of that cockpit door, there's a strict procedure that's followed every step of the way, every navigational aid that's accessed, every communication, every switch, every measurement that's made, every log that's made. Those guys aren't sitting up there watching an in-flight movie. They're doing something very complicated and routine, yes, but strictly regulated procedures that must be followed every step of the way, every single time without fail. That's why we can fly millions and millions and millions of miles every year all around the country, and it's the safest form of travel. It's because of these procedures that have been developed. We can do the same thing going back and forth to the moon. It's not zero gravity. It's approximately 1/6 the gravity we have here on the Earth, but there is a plethora of raw materials. There's iron and aluminum and titanium. There's water and oxygen and H3 in the soil. Plenty of raw materials to fuel its own colony on the moon. And I don't know if long-term residents could be set up on the moon, but certainly long-term operations can be set up on the moon. And we're silly if we don't do it. And that's just the way I feel about it. We'll go ahead and take a quick break. It's about 8 minutes to the top of the hour. just because of the president's comments and the way things went earlier tonight, I'm going to play a little System of a Down just because you're my friends and you'll understand. So we'll be back in about 3.5 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
Disorder. their fires, love neighbors. Flashlight reveries caught in the headlights of a truck. Eating seeds as a pastime activity. The toxicity of our city, of our city.
Disorder, Mr. President. How can you own it? Interesting, interesting song by System of a Down. Listen, if you want to be part of the program tonight, we have now improved, once again, BBS Radio Studios in the paradise of Paradise, California. We now have a toll-free number, all of U.S. and Canada, 888-260-3070. If you want to go out and about for the next couple of hours and listen to us live, you can do so without participating, but you can listen by using your Bluetooth and your cell phone by calling 760-569-7676 and dialing 192-919-pound. Always finding a way for you to participate in the program here at X Squared Radio. By the way, I do have people write from time to time and want to know, how can I become a talk radio host? I think I have what it takes. I have some good ideas. I'd love to help you get started. You could contact me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com, and let me know if you would like to give a shot at being your own talk radio host right here on the BBS Radio Network. Be happy to get you started, help get you sponsored. I think everybody should try it once. I started in 2005 with a one-hour program, expanded to 3 hours, and moved to Sunday nights. And once I got infected, I was cured. So I think you should give it a shot if you think you've got what it takes. Contact me right here at BBS Radio Network, bagnew@x2-radio.com. BBS Radio is the largest internet talk radio network on the planet. More hosts, more channels, more talent, and more traffic than almost any internet talk radio network out there. It's a great place to get your start. And maybe you can unseat X Squared Radio as the number one program on the BBS Radio Network. Bring it on, that's what I say. Can always use more talent. In our last hour, I started talking a little bit about peak oil. And, you know, I've heard articles one way or the other about peak oil. It doesn't exist. Oil is a perpetual flow that comes out of the veins of the earth deep in the crust. And I would say that I've seen a lot of oil fields. Been out in Kentucky and Tennessee and Texas and North Carolina. I've seen the gas wells of East Tennessee and the oil wells of West Tennessee. I could tell you that they do play out. You can drill deeper. You can force acid into the formations. You can force gas and re-inject water. You can inject liquid propane into tar sands, and you can recover more and more at greater expense. Of course, with the high price of foreign oil, it's always profitable to produce domestic oil. That being said, we probably bank a lot of it. We probably have a lot of wells that are capped in this country. You may own one that's capped. Sort of a bank that you can draw on in the future when we have used up all the Middle East's oil. And I would say that there are limiting factors besides the ones that I mentioned. One was force being used to obtain oil at whatever quantity, and the other is to manipulate your currency so that you can obtain oil. Precisely what China does. But there are other limiting factors. You know, the reservoirs do run low. Saudi oil production is like trying to pin a fuzzy tail on a live donkey while you're blindfolded. It's kind of a moving target. April 17th of this year, Reuters reported that the market was oversupplied and that they are slashing prices. Well, 10 days later, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Saudi oil production numbers just don't add up. Here's what they said. Recent oil production figures from Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil exporter, simply don't add up. There are competing explanations for this inconsistency. Some analysts claim that the increase in oil production Saudi officials promised in late February to compensate for lost Libyan supplies was fictitious. Statements from the interpreted and reported, but either scenario contradicts previous statements from Saudi officials. This muddy picture of what the OPEC kingpin is up to is troubling in an oil market already suffering from high prices and extreme uncertainty. Saudi Arabia's oil minister, Ali al-Naimi, told reporters in Kuwait last week, quote, "The market is overbalanced. Our production in February was 9.125 million barrels a day. In March, it was 8.292 million barrels a day." Well, assuming that Mr. al-Naimi was following OPEC norms and quoting average production figures for those months, his numbers are odd to say the least. Shortly after the civil war in Libya erupted in February and halted much of the country's 1.3 million barrels a day of oil production, Saudi Arabia promised to quickly fill the gap. That makes sense. But on February 28th, Saudi officials said they would raise production to 9 million barrels a day, swift action that reassured oil consumers that unrest in the region wouldn't result in supply shortages. Raise production to 9 million barrels a day? However, Mr. al-Naimi's statement contradicts this version of events. According to him, Saudi Arabia was already producing an average of 9.125 million barrels a day. Remember? A day in February. Before the output hike in response to the situation in Libya. So if you add 1.3 million barrels to 9.125 million barrels, I'm getting about 10.4 million barrels a day. And that's not what's being produced. So did the Saudis really pump more oil to make up for the loss of Libyan crude? Analysts at Goldman Sachs and Barclays Capital say no, and so do I. They were producing at 9 million barrels a day since November in response to the strength of demand, says Barclays analyst Amrita Sen. The Voice of America, another publication, also well-respected, said, Several news agencies reported Saturday that the Saudis could increase their oil production by as much as 13% in the coming days to, what I had said earlier, 10 million barrels a day or more. The Saudi newspaper Al Hayat reported that most of the additional output would go to China and other expanding Asian economies. So interesting. The price is not going to change. The amount sold into the market and thus burned into the atmosphere will increase. The reservoir goes lower at a more rapid rate. And the Saudis are drilling for more oil, deeper and more laterally, but at the same rate as last year. Where do I get my source? Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. According to Arabian Oil and Gas Magazine, drilling for oil in top oil exporter Saudi Arabia in 2010 is expected to remain the same as last year, industry sources said on Saturday. But state oil giant Aramco would increase gas drilling activities. Aramco's focus on gas came as the kingdom continues to step up efforts to meet soaring gas demand. By the way, most of that gas demand is coming from the Middle East. Some of it's being liquefied and shipped out, but some of it is being demanded by Israel. And after it completed last year a crude oil expansion project to boost output capacity to 12 million barrels per day was commenced. One source said, here's what they said, we see oil drilling stable. We are not increasing. We are not dropping. We are trying to maintain around 100 rigs for the rest of the year. Now, that's 100 oil rigs. These are onshore rigs that are drilling in the Saudi deserts, and they are doing what's called lateral drilling. This is where a rig will punch a hole in the ground, and then once they get down to a certain depth, they will do lateral drilling off of it, sort of like spider legs going out from that hole. It's called directional drilling, and it's quite lucrative because you only have to drill one hole, one production hole, and then you drill several supply holes down in the ground, and you can cover a lot of real estate without having to set up another rig and drill another hole. So the bottom line is that the holes that were already in the ground that already had pump pipe down in them, they were already injecting gas. They were already injecting, in some cases, the salt water that comes up out of the wells back into the wells, doing what's called reinjection. They were already doing this to keep the production where it was originally. But they're still operating 100 drilling rigs a year. They're still in production. They're still in production. They're still drilling, which means the reservoirs that they already had in the ground are emptying out. They constantly have to drill for more oil. That is where the support for the idea of peak oil gets its legs. What we're talking about when we talk about peak oil is that we are shoveling up our planet, taking this crude oil, and what comes from the Middle East is called light sweet crude, which has got a plethora of all kinds of easily fractionated chemicals in it, diesel fuel, gasoline, toluene, all kinds of solvents and polymers can be gleaned off of this. Of course, the polymers and solvents, you get a lot more out of that than you do gasoline. Gasoline's a really cheap fuel. In Saudi Arabia, I think gasoline is still only 22 cents a gallon. Same in Kuwait. It's only when it's exported and then heavily taxed by nations that have to maintain their roads that we see the prices that we do. In the United States, gas is pretty darn cheap at $3.40, $3.60 a gallon, it's approximately a third of what it is elsewhere in the world. If you want to go buy gas in Europe, you're going to spend close to $10 a gallon. You think a car that gets 17 miles to the gallon is usable in Europe? Not really. Not unless you're very wealthy. And you're going to have to be wealthy because in Europe, they also saddle it with an environmental tax, sometimes 10 to 12,000 euros or more. And if you're going to import that car and it's a V8, it may be prohibited from import. That's right. These muscle cars that go in from the United States are now having to send supercharged and turbocharged V6s in order to qualify. They're still in demand, believe it or not. There are, you know, people over there that have the money and they want an American muscle car. But you can't get the 1,000 horsepower V8s anymore. Nope, can't get them. Going to have to go to a V6, something that's not naturally aspirated. So that's where the idea of peak oil comes from. That's why we have the energy imbalance that we have right now in the world. And frankly, we don't fight much over religion anymore on this planet, even though we like to talk about Islamists and extremists this and extremists that. That's what we like to talk about because, well, to tell you the truth, people don't want to give up their internal combustion engines. So, you know, they kind of look the other way when we send armies over there to ensure that the interests of the United States are maintained through force. We sort of paint it as though it is a war on terror, although that's kind of become an old drumbeat. Now it's more trying to defeat Al-Qaeda. Which we always have some kind of name that goes to it. And there's always some, you know, religious extremist overtone that's placed on it just to make it, you know, more palatable than, yeah, we're going over there to get oil for the country. But that's really what it's all about. There's no more religion wrapped up in this than there is in horse racing. You don't talk about the religion of the horse. You just bet on it and go for it. And it kind of brings us around to, you know, what I want to talk about this hour is the advent of new energy, the advent of using energy in a wiser way. And not just electric vehicles, but solar power is coming of age. I will say of all of the investment money that's been incentivized, not just from the private sector, but also from institutional sources and also from grants and low interest loans and loan guarantees from the federal government. Most of that money has either gone to nuclear power or to solar power. In fact, I would say for startup businesses, solar power and battery technology to support solar power has gotten the lion's share of the money. Now, a lot of people will say, and I have heard analysts right on Fox Business News say that it is a waste of money, that solar power will never pay for itself, that it's never going to be viable. Right now, it's about between 12%, that's the glass-covered solar panels, and 19%, which is the polymer-covered solar panels, efficient. That doesn't sound really efficient, does it? 12% or 19%. But it really is quite efficient. Now, the way this works is the sunlight strikes the fairly solid state chemistry of the crystal itself. It kicks off electrons and forms a current flow, converting the photons of sunlight directly into electricity. It isn't eternal because the boron that's used to coat the silicon that makes the actual electrical current flow eventually gives up all its electrons and it doesn't happen anymore. That being said, the lifespan is 20 years. And it's pretty reliable 20 years. It doesn't drop a whole lot each year. It pretty much puts out at its rated output for perhaps a decade. And then it begins to tail off a little bit. But still, 20 years of pollution-free, free energy from the sun, less, of course, the capital cost to actually buy the panels, the brackets, if you're going to have them track the sun, a tracking mechanism, the battery storage system, and convert the DC into AC so that we can use it the way we're not. Just can tap 3 or 4 or 5 cents a mil back to the power companies. It makes sense. And you can look at it any way you want to look at it. You put solar panels on your home, you're going to go off-grid. You add all the electricity costs that you would have bought before you had the solar panels, you're probably looking at about 5 years of electrical bills. Now, would you rather buy electricity for 5 years, or would you rather invest in the solar panels? I guess that depends on whether you think you're going to be living in that house in 5 years. Most people do not. Most people buy a home and sell it in 5 to 8 years, moving up or moving down, depending on the size of their family or their income situation or the appreciation of the real estate. So that's the story behind solar panels. And I do apologize for the internet quality. We get a little bit of hiccup from time to time. All I can tell you is live with it. It's internet radio. It isn't the studio. They have the fastest internet this side of the sun. It is Comcast, the worst internet this side of the sun. And in Mississippi, it's the worst of the worst. So we'll live with the cracking up. If it becomes unacceptable, call the studio. We'll be happy to hang up. And you can go listen to something else. I'm kidding. They'll do that. We'll hang up and call back and try to get a better connection if it really becomes unpalatable to you, to your ear. But we'll do our best. Just hang in there. I, as you know, do a lot of engineering contracting, which that's what I'm doing down here in southern Mississippi, helping large Fortune 100 company consolidate a couple of locations. That's how I earn the money to stay on the radio and do other things. And living in hotels, it is what it is when you get your internet quality. If you want to be part of the program, and we definitely encourage you to do so, you can now do so toll-free anywhere in North America. 888-260-3070. It will roll over to all of our lines, and you can join the program. By the way, if you've added solar panels to your home or business and you're now off-grid, I'd love to hear about your personal experience, not just acquiring the solar panels, getting the money to buy the solar panels, and the experience of using solar energy as your main source of electricity for your home or business. I'd love to hear about it. We rarely hear real-world personal testimony of what it's like to not have to pay a light bill for the next 20 years. That being said, it's pretty simple technology. You don't have to worry about your lights going out if the big one comes, the big CME. And that's a possibility. You know, I've talked about it. Michio Kaku's talked about it. Other technology providers have talked about it. And it's a serious problem, because if we do get a very strong solar storm, it creates a geomagnetic presence, which is amplified by the very large step-down and step-up transformers. As you know, the power lines, we boost the voltage way up. In the South Tennessee Valley Authority, we typically use 161,000 volts. This is the high-tension lines that you see on the big steel power structures that go across the countryside. This 161,000 volts comes into a switchyard where it is stepped down to 13,800 volts with an auto-tap transformer. This compensates for differences in the voltage depending on what the plant is putting out and what load is being put on it. And the auto-tap transformer can select the right tap on the coils inside of this oil-filled transformer so that exactly 13,800 volts is generated. That's then sent out to 4160 transformers, which then step it down to 440 and then 220 up on your pole that goes into your house. That's how the voltage is broken down all along the transmission line. Some of them are above ground, and some of them in the more modern neighborhoods and industrial parks goes underground. That being said, a geomagnetic storm changes everything, because this extra energy comes into the system, and guess what? It jumps right onto the power lines, and it goes right into the transformers, which are busy trying to compensate for the 161,000 volts, plus or minus a little bit. You throw another million volts on there, and that transformer doesn't know. It just tries to step it down, and when it does, the current flow melts down the core of the transformer. It can take so much overload, but it can't take, you know, something 1,000 times the strength of a good size lightning bolt. It will melt down. Now, when that big transformer, say the 13,800 volt transformer, melts down, there are no spares. There is no spare transformer. These are very expensive transformers, and utilities typically do not keep a spare on hand. If they start having problems with it, they start getting power factor problems or noise in the transformer or a leak in the transformer, they order another one, which could take up to 6 months to be delivered. And they're expensive. And they typically have to raise the money by going to their, you know, their customers for the money. Now, here's the crazy thing. The transformer company, the factory that makes the transformers, also needs electricity in order to make the transformer. But if its power is out because the switchyard has lost its transformer, then the transformer company can't make the transformer to replace the transformer. Now you see the problem. Now, if it's not the big transformer that goes out, but it's, say, the pad mount transformer, that's the green one that's out on the slab in front of your house, or the pole mount transformer, that's the blue-gray one that sits up on the pole, if that one blows, there are some spares for those. But I got to tell you, a lot of consolidation has happened in that industry, because the production of those transformers is directly tied to housing starts. And we all know what housing starts have done in the last 3 years. They've been in the crapper, to say the least. That's why these big companies are having to consolidate operations, lower their costs, and, you know, keep their technology in-house as much as is possible, and try to stay up with production, which is pretty low right now because housing starts are what they are. Bottom line, folks, there are no spare parts for power distribution. No spare parts. That means if we get a geomagnetic storm, you're going to be offline for a while. We're going to have to figure out a way to get a transformer in from somewhere else. Other side of the country, other side of the world, whatever. And then system by system, we will begin bringing it back up. It could take, and I'm a little closer to this than my colleague Michio Kaku is. He's a physicist. I'm an engineer. Out here in the field, I can tell you, it's going to take 5 to 6 years at full production to recover from an event like that. However, if you have solar panels on your home and you're making 2 or 3 kilowatts of electricity by using the sun, while everyone else's lights are out, your lights will be on. And if you're going to really have a hefty system, like 5, 6, maybe even 10 kilowatts, you can run a couple households with that. You can even run your heat pump with it. And you can have heat in the wintertime and air conditioning in the summertime without ever missing a single moment of comfort or convenience in your home. Now, that being said, it's still upwards of $2 a watt, sometimes $3 a watt by the time you figure all the infrastructure, inverters and switching and things that you need. And I would recommend having some spare parts, because if we do get a geomagnetic storm like that, some of the microelectronics may be affected. But you could stay alive. In fact, you could survive in comfort because you have vital things like refrigeration to preserve your food. You know, the number one source of disease in the world, number one, is the lack of refrigeration. Absolutely true. Now, solar technology is getting into everything. It's being put on electric vehicles. They are now creating solar-powered refrigerators so that third world countries can take advantage of having a place to store medicine, a place to store milk and food by using a solar-powered refrigerator. It runs, it's well enough insulated, it can run during the evening and all night on its batteries, and in the sunlight it recharges those batteries and runs the compressor. So you can have the one thing that you need in order to make the jump from a third world country to a developing country, and that's refrigeration. And there's plenty of market for it. And there's plenty of jobs to be created in that field. And there's been no shortage of money poured into that field. You're going to start seeing these solar panel production companies come online very shortly. Some of them are already making laminated polymer solar panels. Yes, the chip is still made in China. Can't get away from that right now. They're just the biggest producers of the chips. The chip is the actual boron silicon chip that actually generates the electricity. The lamination process is done in this country. And they laminate it to different things, fiberglass and aluminum and all kinds of things to make them rigid. And some of them are glass panels, which are not as efficient, but they're certainly plentiful out there, and lots of companies beginning to make those and hire people to make them. So it's an industry that's about to come of age, and I highly suggest that you take advantage of it as soon as you can. There are all kinds of tax credits for doing so. I don't really like the fact that the money's being spent in China that's coming from taxpayer subsidies, but it is what it is. We are a global community, and until there is a U.S. supplier of these chips, we have no choice. So I disagree with Fox Business News saying that it is an industry that will never pay off, because maybe at the current rate or cost of electricity, roughly 3 cents a mil on the West Coast, because most of the power is generated with hydroelectric power, which is dirt cheap. And Lord knows you've had enough rainfall and enough snowfall that that there's no shortage of electricity being generated. In fact, you can't just shut off the dam. You got to let water go through the dam. And so you're making electricity at night that you're not even using. So a lot of these states like Washington and Oregon are giving away electricity practically free just to get industry into their state to start hiring people. Case in point, Moses Lake and the Microsoft servers that are being built there. Very cheap electricity. And in some places, it's as high as 6 or 7 cents a mil, which is still pretty cheap. And honestly, as long as electricity is available at that rate, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to put solar panels on your home or business. But when you consider that there might be an interruption in that power, then it gets a little bit, the equation gets changed a little bit. So with respect to using energy, we have, I think, not been as gluttonous as we've been accused of being in this country. sometimes we're accused of being gluttons because we just have all the electronic toys and we have little red pilot lights burning all around our house 24 hours a day. We have instant on televisions and we have TiVo and cable and this toy and that toy, electric clocks and everything running, consuming electricity. And that might be so. But we can afford it. It's part of our budget. It's part of our lifestyle. And we use that energy that way. Now, when it comes to our vehicles, I think that we really haven't had a lot of choice. Because I think if the American people would have had a choice to buy a Cadillac that, say, got 75 miles to the gallon, they would have bought it. But it wasn't available. You can get a car that gets 40 or 50 miles per gallon, but it's not practical for a lot of people because maybe they have a family of four, or maybe they run a small business and they can't fit everything into a little fit car or a little smart car. They need room. They need a minivan because they have a small soccer team in their house. I got to say, when Dodge came out with the Caravan, it changed everything. Here was a vehicle that got better than 20 miles to the gallon. It was plenty powerful. It had lots of room. It was economic to own. They had a very good maintenance record to them. And it changed everything. And sure enough, Ford and Chrysler and Toyota, actually Chrysler is the one that originated, but Ford and Chevy and Toyota and Nissan, everybody got in the minivan business because Dodge had introduced this wonderful vehicle, Dodge and Plymouth. There's no more Plymouth anymore, but the Dodge brothers brought that innovation to the market. We are fully capable of making vehicles that get 70, 80, and even 90 miles to the gallon right now. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, we are. The hybrid is a baby step. I should say the gasoline-powered hybrid is a baby step. General Motors bought Isuzu back in the early 2000s. Subaru and Isuzu were in the same building in Indiana, and I think they still operate in the same building, but they're separate businesses now. Isuzu's owned by General Motors. As you know, Isuzu is one of the producers, one of the best producers of very small diesel engines. And by very small, I mean like less than a liter. 600cc diesel engines, 1600cc diesel engines. And when you turbocharge these engines, they're quite capable of producing a tremendous amount of torque at very decent RPMs. We're not talking the little 2400 RPM, slugger diesel motors. We're talking about very smooth, very efficient, high torque turbo diesels that are extremely efficient on fuel. Now, if you were to create a diesel hybrid, you could easily get 70, 80, even 90 miles to the gallon out of these diesel hybrids. I had a turbo diesel when I was in the UK that got 44 miles to the gallon and drove at 100 miles an hour all day. Well, that's right. The speed limit in the UK is not 100 miles an hour. I know that. It's 70 miles an hour. But once you get out in the countryside, outside of the traffic cameras, you want to make some time driving to Edinburgh. You don't want to take 8 hours to do it. You can do it in five by traversing the countryside at a little higher speed. There's no Autobahn in the UK. But, be safe about it, and you can do it. So that was a long time ago when I had that car, diesel Peugeot, that ran great. I mean, you couldn't even tell it was a diesel compared to a gasoline-powered motor. It was smooth, it was quiet, it was powerful, and it got fantastic mileage. That kind of technology is available now, already. We don't have to have new technology to do that. Could we do it in this country? You bet we could. Would it be accepted by the American people? Absolutely it would be. I can tell you right now that if you could buy something the size of an Altima that got 75, 80 miles to the gallon, you couldn't keep them in the showroom. You could not keep them in the showroom. The question is, why? The question is, why don't we have these vehicles available in our country? If we're talking about supply and demand here, we're talking about people that would buy them. Why are they not offered for sale in this country? That's a really good question. If you have the answer to it, you can give us a call, 888-260-3070. 888-260-3070. Come on in, and we'll discuss it a little bit. It doesn't have anything to do with the safety regulations. No. Those cars that meet the European standard would meet the U.S. standard. They can be fitted with airbags and smart systems and ABS and all of the systems that we have today. Same vehicle, just a different power plant. Just a different power plant. The Prius is a baby step. The amount of mileage that the Toyota Prius gets is child's play compared to what we can get right now without adding new technology. Now, when we start adding new technology, and I can just tell you that there's no limit. Well, it's going to get asymptotic, I'm sure, with respect to how much it's going to cost. But we could be so much more efficient with the way we drive. You know, a lot of you out there are spending $300, $400, $600 a month on gasoline, driving back and forth to work. It's almost cheaper to have your wife stay at home and watch the kids. No, I'm not trying to be, old-fashioned here. But if you look at the economics, the amount of money it takes for her to drive back and forth to work, for the daycare, for the getting the kids to school in the morning, unless you do it yourself, but watching the kids between 2:30 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon when you get off work, you take that childcare cost and, of course, the loss of the parent in the home all day while especially the young kids who are not in school are being watched by a daycare center, and the additional cost to have her working. It's almost a wash now with as expensive as gasoline is. Figure it out. Do the economics. It's not a pretty picture. But if you could take those gasoline costs out of your economic equation, if you could take that commuting cost from $300, $400, $600 a month down to $30 or $40 a month, I'm not talking about the long trips. I'm not talking about going and visiting your grandmother in Atlanta or Buffalo. I'm talking about the back and forth to work driving, the 18 miles one way to work and 18 miles home, all those little trips you make back and forth to the grocery, the soccer field, the doctor's office, all those little trips, and you take gasoline out of that equation. You now have changed your economic situation. You've added somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000 a year tax-free back to your economic situation. Now you've got economic stimulus on a local level. Big difference. So why isn't it happening? Why isn't it working? These are all great questions. There are answers to it. And I don't want to get too conspiracy theory about this, big oil's not going to allow you to do it. Maybe big oil is out there slowing things down in Washington. I could tell you most of the reason why this is not happening is because of government regulations. Yeah, I'm serious. Government regulations are not allowing this technology to hit the streets. Because it has placed certification processes in the way that make it prohibitively expensive with respect to capital cost and with respect to licensing costs for the manufacturer to deliver these vehicles. Let me clarify that a little bit. Yes, General Motors could afford it. Yes, Toyota could afford it. Ford could afford it. Yes, they could bring these vehicles to market because they already have these licenses. They already have the technology. They already have the ability to bring these vehicles to market. But they are not going to. And it's not because of big oil. It's because of big car makers, okay? They already make a car or a truck in that class. They're not going to build another vehicle that takes less employees and less parts to build and replace a vehicle that they already make. There's no win for them. Why would they shut down one plant to start up another plant that hires less people to make a vehicle? It makes no economic sense for them. Okay? They're not going to make a car that replaces a car they already make. It's like taking a trade-in on a car and selling it for the same amount of money that you took it as a trade-in. You have to make two transactions to make your money. That doesn't work economically. You have to make money both ways. So electric vehicles or these high-mileage hybrids are only going to come to the market through independent car companies. Well, now you've really changed the situation. Now, it's not the oil companies that are trying to stop these independent car makers from bringing the cars to market. It's the car companies that are stopping these independent car companies from bringing these cars to market. That's the whole economic picture of it, okay? General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Toyota, they all have lobbyists. They all have lawyers. They all have salespeople and technical sources of information in Washington that deliver large packages of information to legislators so that they can make smart legal decisions when it comes to creating new legislation or amending old legislation and laws that are on the books. Those amendments and those pieces of legislation are going to be geared toward keeping big car companies in business and keeping small car companies out of the business because they don't want the competition. But that is not how economics works. That's not how free trade works. That isn't how capitalist systems work. Once you start putting regulations in there that prevent the natural market demand from taking its course, you have set up an entire industry for bankruptcy. So let's see what our listeners have to say about this. Alyssa, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. I was listening to a TED Talk last night, and I really wish I could remember the guy's name now, but he was talking about this energy proposal that they're rolling out in a couple of years. I guess he had worked with the Tesla Institute and all of that, and they are partnering with a couple of other countries who are actually almost like outlawing other forms of, of course, the driving the prices really high, kind of like how Europe already has them with the high gas prices already, but just really trying to force people into being more conscious of being green because, of course, we're kind of killing ourselves by doing things, the way that we are. And so it was really interesting to hear that and then, of course, to hear your segment about the legislation, the blockades and the different things that it just has set up to dissuade us from doing anything differently. What's preventing us from, adopting a practice like that where we do have more of a environmentally conscious kind of moral code to our country to where we do give incentives, kind of like what the government's doing with the solar power, but to incentivize buying the electric cars, buying the, because I guess what this guy was talking about, the electric cars are actually, I guess it's a catalytic converter that's just producing, every time you brake, it actually recharges the battery. And then that battery will then put energy back into the grid. There are little battery cell stations all over these cities that it just wirelessly, of course, as Tesla does, feeds the energy back into the grid. So they actually, this guy was talking about giving people checks, because if they feed enough energy back into the grid, then they're essentially they'll get reimbursement back from the energy company.
The idea is really interesting. The idea is to collect the energy that's stored in the car's batteries during the peak load periods, like during the daytime when the air conditioners are running full blast, and then allow the cars to charge back up at night when electricity is cheap. So it's kind of a give and take kind of trade-off system, and it works very well. And it's the technology all exists right now. I think right now there are 12 electric vehicle companies in the United States. There used to be 29, but 17 of them have gone bankrupt. And I was saddened to hear that that Think has filed bankruptcy a second time, because they, you know, all these car companies have a pretty good product that they're trying to bring to market. And you got Phoenix, and you got Zap, and you had others that had a solution that some portion of the public would buy. They're all niche markets anyway. The problem is not the market. The people would buy them. The showrooms would sell them. Jobs were ready to be had, some 45 or 50,000 jobs, good paying jobs, ready to go to work. The two problems that stop the whole thing from happening are access to capital and the government regulations, which are constantly shifting. They're getting ready to change again in 2012. The braking systems are changing. The roof crush capabilities are changing, all in the name of safety, I'm sure. Not really. But what it's designed to do is make the cost of bringing a vehicle to market so high that an independent car company just can't do it. And that's the sad part. I mean, the vehicles that are being made now by these electric car companies are safer than 95% of the vehicles that are on the road today.
Right. But they're just, so that's the beauty of our capitalistic,
Well, it's not really the capitalistic society. It's the way that government works. Large multinational corporations can pay for lobbyists and can literally buy legislators so that these regulations constantly shift in their favor.
Right. I'm a chiropractor, so I can completely understand the lobbying with the big pharma.
Absolutely.
I keep coming back to the government just needing to change their paradigm, because they can make more money just by getting more people to put energy into the grid and utilize that for of course, if there any new technology that comes in, the old technology, the people are afraid of job losses, just like what you were talking about with the military bases and things like that. But there's always regeneration of something else, and other things tend to take over and kind of bring more progress and more prosperity. Are we just needing to start a people's revolution to bring about certain
I really like the idea, Lisa. I got to tell you, this whole idea of a bloodless revolution becomes more and more attractive, especially down there in Texas, since they just signed the new Sovereignty Act. Texas and Tennessee have now joined 32 other states. All we need is 5 more states, 37 states, and we will have a 2/3 ratifying majority of states in the U.S., and we can have a constitutional convention, and we can take care of business on a state level instead of a federal level.
That's cool. See, I don't have a TV. John Stewart is where I get my news.
I like John Stewart. He's brilliant. Him and Colbert. I actually, one of the neat things I watched John Stewart do one night is Obama had made the statement that we were addicted to foreign oil and that, you know, he was going to stimulate alternative sources of energy. And John said, wow, what an amazing idea. Have we ever heard that before? And then he went and played George W. Bush playing it, and then George Bush playing it, and then Clinton playing. He went all the way back to Carter, 8 presidents, every single president had said the same words. It was amazing. Yeah. It was brilliant. John Stewart is brilliant.
Well, so what's, because I know on your website you've got an electric car on there. So what's one of the
Vision Motor Cars makes right now a small electric pickup truck. It's the only highway-ready electric pickup truck in the market. I try to keep the two worlds separate, but sometimes the lines get blurred. And it's been a lot of years we've been working on it. We were ready to go into production in November of 2009 with it, and the grants got given to the major car companies instead of independent car companies. So, and that's just a matter of tragedy, economic tragedy in our country. So a lot of us were capable of technologically working around that, and now we've complied with all the regulations, and we're getting ready to be able to sell those in the United States. And there's certainly enough demand for them.
Yeah. Well, especially at 80 miles to the gallon.
Well, actually, that truck gets 300 miles to the gallon.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, the same money that you would spend for a gallon of gasoline will take you 300 miles instead of 100 miles.
Wow. Now, here's a thought with the gearing systems with the car. Why couldn't we put some kind of output modulator, amplifier on some of these, like the wind energy and, maybe even the electric. Of course, that'd be difficult with solar, but, just to get more out of I don't know if that makes sense, to kind of up gear and put more torque into the system just to create more energy collection, if you will.
Well, you're talking about zero point energy or collecting energy from the environment. You could do that, but it would take an antenna the size of a parking lot to gather enough energy to run a vehicle. That being said, the batteries have gotten a lot more efficient, especially in the last 3 years. We've had lithium iron phosphate that's now getting pretty close to being cost effective. It was twice as expensive as it is now a couple of years ago, and now it's tougher and it holds its charge better and lasts 7 years instead of 3. And there's lithium titanium technology coming in a couple of years, and there's nanotechnology coming in a couple of years. It's not ready yet, but it'll get there. And the motors are getting more efficient and much more reliable. Cars are getting lighter and stronger. So the technology is moving, but it's going to take, getting the vehicles on the road to actually make that demand happen. Right now, there are no electric cars sold in America except for the Nissan Leaf, and they're 2 years behind delivery.
So we just got to get out of our own ways.
Well, I think what it's going to take is it's going to take some states like Texas stepping forward and saying, we are not going to allow the federal government to keep these cars off the roads. We need them. We need them now. These companies need the revenue. We need the jobs. There's no downside to having these electric car companies go into production. We're ready right now to hire people and crank out vehicles. We're ready today.
Well, and an interesting thing, they actually put in a couple of electric car charging stations in the city that I live in. And so it's,
well, that's good.
They're always, yeah. So, I think for as, southern and, not as advanced as I think most people view the South, there's a growing, well, especially Austin, there's a growing effort for, being a little bit more progressive and aware of our environmental impact. But I really like what you said about the oil, that we're not, there's no more wars, religious wars, I mean, so to speak. I think that's a controlling factor that I think a lot of people kind of like to throw out there for justifications, like the Crusades.
Well, you know, I was actually having a discussion with a member, a leading member of our military not long ago. And he gave me a whole new reason to really love electric vehicles. He said, you know, when we deploy overseas, we have to obviously keep our troops and supplies and everything on wheels. And that means they have to have engines, and that means they have to have fuel. We deploy these fuel bladders into forward positions so that we can obviously keep our vehicles from running out of gas. He said, we're losing one soldier for each fuel deployment, and that cost is too high. He said, if we had electric vehicles that could actually operate in these forward positions and would refuel themselves with solar power like our trucks, we could save that life.
Well, and I think that big as the movement of supporting our troops are, I think that would be a huge motivating factor for the American people to start their awakening process.
How about not having to send our troops in the first place because we're no longer fighting over oil?
Well, but so this is another thing that I was thinking of. It seemed like at some point, and I'm not exactly sure what brought this into being, but the power struggle seemed to emerge between electric versus gas. And you know, the petroleum, petrol energy lines.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, electricity is 100% American made. We don't import electricity.
Right.
But 64% of our fuel is imported.
I was just wondering what the you know, if there's not to go into a conspiracy, but just a, you know, kind of like how, of course, I'm equating back to just kind of that big pharma presence of, you know, some kind of, well, of course, so you talked about the gas, the car manufacturers being the large lobbying entity, which, of course, you know, derives their power from the gas and petrol. So where did that, I know that's kind of where the car kind of started, but at the same time, once electricity kind of came on the radar screen, Einstein and Tesla, because I know they started playing around with, engines, electric engines back then.
Sure. Whole cities.
Electric
buses and electric trains. But there's still electric cars that are operating today that were built back then. Absolutely. And you remember when the first vehicles were built, they didn't run on gasoline. They ran on alcohol and they ran on vegetable oil. It wasn't until Prohibition was passed in 1920 that cars had to switch to gasoline because it was illegal to make your own alcohol. That was Rockefeller.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, and he also shut down, maybe it wasn't Rockefeller, shut down the hemp because it was competing also with the gas and paper
cotton
manufacturing. Yeah, cotton.
It competed with cotton. Hemp is a marvelous, marvelous plant. It can be used for all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. But, well, anyway, I feel like I'm having a private radio show with you, so I better
let
you get back to your...
It's just you and me, Elisa, just between us and about 12 million other listeners. You're doing great.
Well, cool. Well, thank you very much. And I sent you an email. On the X Squared radio link, I actually never heard of you until yesterday. I had a patient come in, and I was talking about some of my theories as of late, and she was like, you really need to read Remembering the Future. And I was like, okay. And she said, oh, have you not heard of Brooks, hadn't you? Well, no, but now I'm going to go look him up. And I read the very first page of the Remembering, that main site. Like, huh, you find you? I've never come across anybody who has put my thoughts into words as poignantly as you have. And so it was just really interesting just to kind of connect with a kindred spirit.
Wow, I really appreciate that so much. That book was a couple of years in the making, and I actually wrote the introduction, then I wrote a preface on top of that because I was kind of going in two different directions, and my publisher said, well, why don't you write an introduction and a preface? And so the introduction, it actually makes or breaks the reader. If they get to that point and they're ready to let go of dogma and they understand that there's a place for science in figuring out the purpose of life, I guess, they're gonna hook up with it. And your words really mean a lot to me. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I know there are other people out there. We're just kind of, I don't know, looking for a direction or, not wanting to be the first ones to, to stand up and go against the grain. But I think it's time. I think the critical mass is approaching, and it's been cycled throughout history, though. I mean, it's not the first time where people have come to different understandings of, kind of waking up and crawling out of the cave. This isn't the first time that we're doing this. I mean, it's just on a different conscious level. But yeah. It's always interesting to see the, kind of who's out there. And I just never knew that there was somebody out there that had as similar thoughts that I did. So that was really, that sent chills when I read that page. So it was cool.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, let's take a really quick water break here. I'll play part of the song by Muse, Uprising. Just have to play it. And then we'll bring Steve on from San Diego. Hang on, Steve. We'll get to you.
Oh,
And welcome back to X-Squared Radio, coming to you live from Southern Mississippi. If you want to be part of the program, toll-free North America, 888-260-3070. Missoula, Montana, the race director of a 100-mile ultra-marathon foot race through the Flathead National Forest has been canceled. The event was snowed out in July. Yeah, the snow won't melt in time for the event scheduled for July 29th. He said postponing the race would pose problems with shortening daylight hours and increased grizzly bear activity. This is only the second year for the race. Last year, 44 people started, only 20 finished. The remainder were eaten by bears. No, I'm kidding. They just quit because it was a 100-mile race. No one was eaten by bears. By the way, a snowbird has up to 500% more snowpack than ever before. For the second year in a row, summer never arrived. The snowpack will get snowed on this coming winter, revitalizing something that has been missing from the Wasatch Front for thousands of years, a glacier. That's right. Those of you who have been listening to X Squared Radio for a few years will remember a 2008 broadcast from the year 2015. Yeah, there's also some reference to this in my latest book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. The snow will not melt, just as I predicted in 2008. I recently flew from Phoenix to Portland, and I saw something I have never seen before in June. In fact, I don't think anyone has ever seen this before in June. I saw green. I saw snow for 1,000 miles on every mountain. That's right. There was no rock visible anywhere above 7,000 feet. The lakes were full and filling even higher. Even Mount Adams was completely covered in snow. The temperature reached the low 60s during the day and plunged into the 40s at night. Global cooling? Perhaps. Every glacier in the world is reporting growth. The coming winter, we may see for the first time the fully developed counterclockwise hurricane patterns that can create a superstorm, the beginnings of an ice age. How about that? Hey, let's go ahead and bring a caller. We've had him sitting on the line. Steve from San Diego, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Good evening, Dr. Agnew. I just want to let you know that here in San Diego, we've got temperature in the 80s. So, but we did have a very cool spring, and a lot cooler than normal. But now we've finally gotten our summer weather. So the people are going to the beach.
But that Pacific Ocean is about, 72 degrees?
We have a very narrow temperature cycle. At night in the winter, the coldest winter nights, it hardly ever reaches freezing. And in the summer, it usually doesn't get up into the 90s, except when we get these Santa Ana conditions, when the air comes out of the mountains and flows westward instead of east.
Oh, that's right.
And then we do get some high temperatures. But the ocean keeps us very temperate normally. Yeah. Anyway, the reason I called, you mentioned these electric vehicles. Maybe you've heard of the MDI compressed air car.
Oh, sure, yeah.
That's really a good way to store electric when you think about it, because you have the compressor running all night, the small compressor that's built into the car. You charge it up with air, and it's not like a battery, that will eventually wear out, maybe after so many thousand cycles. The compressed air will, unless the tank itself deteriorates, you're going to have continued use of that tank, and you have 100% clean emission, just like you do with an electric vehicle. So, and it can be filled up much faster. The advantage is if you were to have a large air compressor at a gas station, you can fill it up much faster than you could fill up storage batteries.
Well, how much pressure do they contain? Because I know at a gas station, you're only going to get around 100 pounds per square inch.
Well, I should have checked on the technology before I called you, but it's a very small air compressor that's built into the car that takes all night. But they said a gas station size compressor can fill it within about 6 to 10 minutes. So I'm just going by what they've advertised, you know.
I think it's a cool idea. I mean, you're just, you know, basically running a compressor just like you would a gasoline engine. In fact, Smith makes compressors by using a Ford 302 engines. They take one of the cylinder heads off, they put a compressor head on it, and they run four cylinders as a gasoline-powered motor, and the other four cylinders are the air compressor. It's a pretty neat idea.
Well, I never heard of that either. That sounds even better, actually.
But
you might be able to use the exhaust from the four cylinders to run the other four cylinders or something.
Well,
there are
all kinds of innovative ideas out there, and they all have, you know, a niche. Our little truck is, you know, designed for light delivery. It goes about 100 miles on a charge. It costs about $1 to recharge it. So it has its niche. It's affordable. It's, you know, just a simple vehicle. It's not very complex. It's not as fancy as a Volt or a Tesla. But it is a good, reliable vehicle that will last for 20 or 30 years.
I thought that, you know, although you seem to think it's the car companies, I still believe that in the end it's the energy companies that are controlling a lot of the technology in the country and put barriers to it. Now, I see countries like India bypassing those regulations, building a $2,000 car. Now, from what I understood, Tata Motors was supposed to build this compressed air vehicle that's licensed by MDI. But I haven't heard any news about it, so I don't know how well it's selling or how well it performs. And
well,
I believe
sold, except Tata is going out of business. Their quality was so poor that the Indian people wouldn't buy it. And the other car, which was the Riva, I think is what it was called, had nice instrumentation, but it also has been rejected by the Indian market.
Well, yeah. Well, I understood that they were supposed to sell that one car for $2,000, and maybe it is that shoddy. I really don't know, but it sounded like maybe this would be a way to bypass the restriction in this country. But in the end, you're right. Everybody wants quality. Nobody wants to drive a piece of junk. It's essential that it should have a certain quality standard before it's sold on the open market. And that's probably why the Indian people have chosen not to buy them then. Sad to hear it, but
I think so. But, you know, at the end of the day, in this country, it's all about jobs. You know, this is an industry that could create 40 or 50,000 jobs in a month. I've got 700 job applications sitting on my desk, and to hear the stories of these people that have worked in assembly, they've worked in automotive industry, some of them most of their lives, and they're out of work. And, you know, I've had them come in the building and say, look, I'll sweep floors for free. I just got to have a job, whatever it takes, you know. It just breaks my heart. We're so ready to go to work, and we can't.
Well, I wish I knew the real true reason why this is happening, but if you ask me, everything that's been happening for the last few years looks like it was designed to bring this country down. And why that is, I don't know. I don't have any theory, but that's the way it looks to me, because any sane person would never export all their work and factories to China and lower the export levels to zero. You're just asking for complete destruction of the local economy, and that's what's going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, Steve. You know, until the end of World War II, America's economy was almost completely self-sufficient. Everything it consumed, it also produced. And the big shift away from manufacturing came as the U.S. sought to speed the recoveries of war-ravaged Europe and also Asia. Trade barriers fell significantly, and soon, really, American companies were sending emissaries abroad looking to do business cheaper by expanding their operations overseas. Well, there's been another trend, and it's starting to take place, and this is Fortune magazine has just reported this. It's a phenomenon called reshoring. This means that businesses are beginning to come back to the U.S., and they say they're coming back for three reasons. One, overseas workers are getting more expensive. You know that's going to happen eventually. People get used to money. The second is that shipping costs keep increasing. And the third is that global supply chains have shown weak links, which basically means you can't rely on China to deliver stuff. So they're starting to come back. Caterpillar, Boeing, GM, they are starting to come back. But, you know, there are small businesses, thousands of them in this country that are ready to go back to work today. They have good ideas, they've got passion, they've got markets, but they can't get access to capital.
Well, who has all the capital? The oil companies.
No, actually, it's the banks and insurance companies that own everything. They even own the oil companies.
Well, I'm not 100% certain of that, but... The insurance companies do also have a lot of power. I've seen that in the way they got into the Medicare situation. The drug companies wrote the bill themselves. Apparently, they have a lot of economic leverage over our congressmen, and they allowed them to write the rules for that drug plan. And so the same thing with the planned public medical program. It was supposed to be a government-run program, and pretty soon most of the states had the insurance companies in it. So I always think of a medical plan where you put in the money into a fishbowl. The people put the money into the fishbowl, and the doctors take it out. And then you have a third hand going in there, the insurance company, and they're grabbing the money out in between, and they're supposed to make a profit and give their executives big salaries every year. It can't be any cheaper than if you would have it run by the government. It can't be, you know. So there's the, you know, that's one of the problems. The insurance companies have ruined that. They've ruined this public medical plan, and they've ruined... in my estimation, they've ruined Medicare, too. I think eventually it'll go broke due to that drug plan, although they say that portion is making a profit, but they're really getting money from Medicare to fund these drugs.
Well, the one, and I'm sure Alicia would agree with me, the one thing that people fail to do when they look at this subject, Steve, is they fail to separate health insurance from health care. I could never afford health insurance growing up, but I could afford health care. There's a big difference. Somehow, in our rhetoric, we think that affording health insurance is the way we afford health care. And they're so different. Health insurance will cost you $90,000 in a lifetime. Nobody spends more than that in health care growing up. You know, I raised four kids. Paid for them all cash, paid for all my health care cash, paid for the braces, paid for the dental bills, every medical bill we ever had out of my pocket. And I'm about 90 grand ahead of the game. So are 85% of Americans. Only 15% of Americans actually need insurance.
Well, I agree with you completely. I mean, as far as the health area, I think it could be so much cheaper if the insurance companies were not involved. It's like an extra hand grabbing money in between the person who's needing the care and the doctor who is providing it. If there's three hands in that fishbowl, the doctor is either going to get less money for treating the patient, or the patient is going to have to fork over more money to get treatment, because the insurance company is taking a significant portion in between.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, if you go to your doctor or go to a doc in a box and tell him you're going to pay cash, you're going to get very reasonable health care.
Yes, I think most doctors will give you a discount if you pay cash. That's what happened with I went off of insurance when I had dental insurance, and I told the dentist, I said, well, I won't be able to have insurance anymore with you. Because they're cutting out my plan. And he says, well, if you pay cash, I'll give you a discount. And that's what's happened since then. I've been paying less for the same treatment that they were charging the insurance company. And I think they play somewhat of a game there. They charge more than they're going to really expect to get. And then they average it out and they say, well, this is not really an average cost, and we're only going to pay 80% of that. And so you'll have to pay the 20%, and somehow or other, it seems like you always end up paying 50% anyway after you have the insurance plan. So,
well, the one thing we need to realize as citizens of Earth and of the United States, the headwaters of all their money, we're the only ones really putting money into the system. We're the ones earning the wage. We're the ones that put the money into the bank. We're the ones that pay the insurance premiums. If we decided where we were going to spend our money and how we were going to spend our money, we could control all these businesses. But we have to act as a people.
That's very hard to do. But I applaud your idea. I can just see... Among my own friends, we never can seem to come to the same consensus. And a lot of it I have to blame on these talk shows that I believe are funded by the same people that are inhibiting the technology growth. And as Adolf Hitler used to say, if you tell a lie enough times, people will start believing it. And that's essentially what they do. They misinform the public according to their agenda. And the people who are hurt by their agenda buy the premise. You know, I remember talking 2 years ago to my friend who's a very conservative-minded person, and I told him, I can see this whole thing going now. They're selling you the idea that spending is the problem in the government, and they're going to cut spending, and what they're going to cut spending on is Social Security and Medicare. I can see this happening. And 2 years later now, this is exactly the point we've come to, because they were planning to do this all along.
I heard it said the other day, and it's one of the most brilliant things I have heard said of late in this whole debate. We don't need more taxes. We need more taxpayers. Let's put some people at work.
That's another way to get more money. I think the single most important thing is to have a balanced budget and not go into debt, because we're giving such a great percentage of our national income to service the debt that we can't run our government services anymore. So the only solution...
This is making the interest on that debt. It's the Fed, it's China, it's Japan, it's Europe. They're the ones that are making the interest on that debt.
Yes, I realize that. The Federal Reserve System, and that is an illegal system that was installed during Woodrow Wilson's administration and should have never passed legally through the Justice Department, because Congress said the authority to coin and print money belongs to the Congress of the United States, not to a private bank. And when they passed that law, which was, in my opinion, illegal, they set up this debt system so that getting the country into debt is the most important thing for the Fed, because that's how they make their money. The more we go into debt, the more money they make. And if we were printing our own money, there wouldn't be any debt now. There would still be inflation. If we were printing more money than we should, obviously inflation would increase, but there still would be no national debt. In other words, all the income of the country would be servicing the services of the country, not the private banking industry.
Yep, that's exactly what Thomas Jefferson warned about, and Woodrow Wilson accomplished what Alexander Hamilton could not.
I don't know if you heard the story about Lincoln during the Civil War going to the banks in New York and trying to borrow money to run the war, and they wanted 33% interest. And Lincoln came back to Washington ashen-faced, and he talked to one of his close advisors, and I believe his name was Parker. I could be wrong, but as I recall the story, and Parker told him, well, it's simple. You can print your own money. You have the authority to do so. You don't need to borrow any money. You have the authority to print the greenbacks. And by the end of the war, the North had funded all its own obligations, and it didn't have any debts. The country was more prosperous at the end of the Civil War than it was at the beginning, but eventually they did have economic downturns because of the natural economic cycles that do occur, from ups and downs.
That's how Germany tried to pay its way out of reparations, and it was suffering from 1,500 to 2,000% inflation. And it wasn't until U.S. banks went over and loaned Hitler's people the money to start up manufacturing. So it was actually American industrialists that made the money by funding the Third Reich.
Yes, that happened a little bit afterwards. So what happened first after the First World War was over, Germany had to turn over all its gold and silver assets, plus they were required to provide France and England with so much coal and steel per year. Now, how they were going to pay their workers doing that was left up to the Germans. So they had this mining interest. They had to pay these miners to do this work. And they started printing money. So in 1920, the Versailles Treaty was in 1919, and you could say this economic operation then started in 1920. They started printing money to pay their workers, and if you were a German and you had 100,000 marks in the bank in 1920, you could buy yourself a home. But by 1923, inflation has gotten so bad that same 100,000 marks couldn't even buy a postage stamp to send a letter to your family member.
Exactly.
So what happened is that the people started bartering instead. They would need a wheelbarrow of money just to buy a loaf of bread. Well, that became inconvenient, and they started bartering. The barter system came in. And that's when I think it was Calvin Coolidge No, wait a minute. Who was that other president after Calvin Coolidge? I can't think of his name offhand. I'm getting older and I'm having more problems remembering. But anyway, it was the president after Calvin Coolidge. He's the one that went over there and he said, if Britain and France wants all this money from the German reparations, they're just going to get worthless paper. So they renegotiated the repayment plans, and they helped them organize a new monetary system at the same time. And now by the time Hitler came around in 1933, he was elected chancellor in 33. So between 23 and 33, the economy ran according to that American bailout. And then in 33, Hitler actually did what the reverse of what Woodrow Wilson did. He instituted a plan without debt and got the German economy really super fired by leaving the banks out of the equation. So everybody loved him for giving them economic prosperity, and that's how he bartered that economic prosperity into his political agenda, which was, sad to say, very evil.
Right. I remember by 1933, the animosity between industry and the banks had grown to such a state that Hitler was able to seize power, supported by industrialists, and he later went in and seized the assets of the banks by force.
He got the, as far as I know, he got the banks out of the system. He made it a pure pay and pay-as-you-go system, and the prosperity picked up almost overnight. And then sure, they started the public works programs like the auto bonds and the VW plant, which hardly produced any autos, and because the war was just around the corner, and then they turned it into making Jeep type vehicles for the duration of the war.
Yep. Kubelwagen.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't until the end of the war that the British allowed him to make the civilian version again. So, that banking system, the debt banking system, is very harmful, and it's been very harmful to our country. And the debt that has gone in, I think since the beginning of the Bush administration, when he cut the taxes of the wealthy, and, you know, people will say, well, he just cut the taxes. Well, I didn't get very much. I think if I remember right, I got a check for $200. And I've been paying roughly the same taxes since then. But anyway, be that as it may, the important thing is that he unbalanced the budget. And the debt was around $5 trillion when he took over from Clinton, and it ended up $11 trillion before he left office. The last $2 trillion were due to the collapse of the banks, Wall Street banks, right at the end. But it was $11 trillion when he left office. And
Debt is anything back from it. That was it was all outgoing, nothing coming back in. It was no way to recoup anything. It was just all expenditure going out all the time for national defense.
Exactly. I believe that people who in the Republican Party, what do they call them? They don't tread on me. Conservatives. All you have to do is eliminate spending. Well, apparently they can't do that. They can't cut the spending on the programs that they want.
Yeah.
So now they've come down where they're.
We really should do, if we're really looking for a solution, Steve, is we have to do away with income tax and corporate tax altogether and go to a national sales tax, bring all those millions and millions and millions of taxpayers into the system by getting all the people that are paid and spend cash into the system, all the illegal aliens and everyone into the system, so that everybody is paying some federal tax, and bring the corporations back to the U.S. by eliminating the corporate income tax, and that will fix everything.
Well, I'm not 100% sure, but I sure would like things to be changed. And I knew where the spending cuts are going to be coming from now. It's going to be Social Security and Medicare. And I know when the new taxes are passed, it's not going to be on the upper portion of the population. It's going to be on the lower earners. That's the way I see it coming up. But who knows?
I mean, the bottom 40% of the earners don't pay any tax at all. You know,
there are some people that don't pay any. That's correct. I don't know how they'll eliminate that.
The only way to do it is with a national sales tax. If you're going to get the people that buy stuff, which is really the only constitutional way to tax people, is a use tax. It's a value-added tax. Income tax is just not ethical at all. It's none of your business what people make or what they earn. And we shouldn't have to disclose what we earn. It's a violation of our privacy. And nobody tells the truth anyway, or very few people do. So just get it on the spend side. Let people make all the money they want to make and just get it on the buy side, and it'll fix everything.
Well, the debt we have now, between $13 and $14 trillion since Obama has come in, I don't know if it ever can be repaid, and I fully expect that the countries we owe debts to, including the Federal Reserve, are going to be hunting for assets. So you're going to be seeing bridges that are built already and freeway systems that are built already being taken as assets to satisfy the loan repayment to these people that own our debt. And they'll be charging us tolls to use the roads, to use the bridges, maybe to use the national parks. That's the step I see coming now.
Yeah, don't forget
that's how far into debt we have gone.
Don't forget there are 25,000 federal buildings that they own, too.
Well, they'll probably be selling those as well. That's my guess. I mean, that's my best guess of what's going to happen. Who knows? Maybe the Chinese army will come here to seize the assets that are required to satisfy their debt. I'm not sure. And then we would have to ask them if they could please sell us 50 million bullets so we could fight them off. That's how bad it's gotten.
Yeah, well, we'll have to ask the federal government for permission to grow wheat on all that CRP land that they've told us we can't use anymore.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve,
anyway, my original point was about the air-powered car, but since we got it off into this sidetrack here, that is really now the problem. The problem is the lack of money. And you're right, the entrepreneurial money is not there, but I believe the oil companies, the banks, and the insurance companies have plenty of money. It's just I don't know what they're going to be doing with it. I have
no
idea.
I was talking to Dennis Kucinich last November, and he indicated there's some $2 trillion worth of investment money sitting on the sidelines just waiting. For what?
He's one of my heroes, by the way. He's, along with Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich is, I believe those are the only two major politicians that really think about the benefits to the average citizen in the country.
Ron Paul's the only presidential candidate that even mentioned the words Federal Reserve. And he's a brave soul for doing it.
There's a certain amount of danger. People have, I don't know if you know the stories, but the father of Charles Lindbergh was a senator in Minnesota, and he tried to get the Federal Reserve rescinded, and he got beaten up severely, and they intimidated him into quitting. And then there was a congressman, I believe his name was Nick McFadden, that was poisoned under mysterious circumstances while he was trying to get the Federal Reserve Act revoked. So I think the people close to the close with knowledge of this system, they know the danger of opposing it.
Well, it's powerful stuff. They might be the headwaters of everything down at Wars R Us. We have no idea. Yeah. Steve, thanks so much for the phone call. I'm glad you're doing well down there in San Diego. Please call back anytime.
Okay. Nice talking to you, Dr. Agnew. I enjoy your programs all the time. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, we were talking earlier about access to capital and small business, and I had talked about this reshoring phenomenon that seems to be, I'm not going to say it's in full swing. I'm not seeing that yet. But it used to be a no-brainer to move labor to China because it was so cheap. But now it's, $26 in the U.S., about $4.50 in China. It's still a big difference, but it's no longer a no-brainer, okay? It's now worth thinking about. And there are other things like protecting your intellectual property and things like that, which we always have problems with when we go to foreign countries, but particularly to China. But states like Texas and Tennessee are attracting these companies to come back. They are growing at a rate 50% higher than states that have corporate taxes and income taxes. You know, Tennessee and Texas do not. Now, that's still not very high, mind you, but the difference in growth rate tells the entire story. These states realize that when a person gets a paycheck, he or she is likely to spend about 75% of that check inside the state of residence, right? They're going to buy fuel. They're going to buy clothes. They're going to buy food. They're going to buy all kinds of goods and services inside the state. Well, the taxes paid on those sales are instant revenues to the states, and it stimulates companies to hire more people. Seems like a simple enough formula. It is provable. Every single state that has no income tax, South Carolina, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, Montana, they're all growing much faster than other states in the country. It, however, is a formula that has completely evaded the White House understanding for nearly half a century. The solution is simple. Eliminate corporate income tax on the federal level. Done. Done. A small federal sales tax would generate windfall revenues as tens of millions of new taxpayers would be added to the system overnight. I mean, come on, people. This is simple economic science. There's no voodoo here. It's so simple a fourth grader could understand it. Right now, cash transactions make up roughly half the commerce in America. Can you believe that? A huge portion of those cash transactions generate zero tax revenue. None. They're off the books. Okay. Now for the second and perhaps even more important reason why manufacturing is going to be slow to reshore. Access to capital. Now, I don't mean to say that multinational global corporations can't lay their hands on capital in numerous exchanges. They can. That's not the problem. But they are not the job creators. Small business makes up the majority of job creators. For instance, Charlotte, North Carolina has one of the nation's highest ratios of single location businesses. Okay, translation. Small business and maximum diversity makes up the Charlotte job market. Okay, single location businesses are small businesses. The problem is that more than 3,000 Small Business Administration loans remain unprocessed and unfunded in North Carolina alone. There is no money moving to these businesses to help them expand. Many of these businesses have the sales to grow. They've got the sales. They can't find the capital to add machines and floor space and inventory to meet that demand. Without stuff in stock, the sales go elsewhere. So while thousands of these businesses are hacking their way through mile-high hedges of red tape, laced with plenty of briars, I might add, the global billion-dollar corporations can take their sweet time milking every last dime of profit out of foreign labor because their potential competitors here in the U.S. can't afford to buy the parts to fill the orders to compete against them. Okay? In the United States today, small businesses constitute about one half of the private economy in terms of output and jobs. But they receive almost no investment from the nation's pension funds or from mutual hedge venture or any other kind of investment funds. In 2007, almost $30 billion was invested in green technology in the United States. In 2009, it shrunk to $2 billion. In 2010, less than $2 billion. And in 2011, not even $1 billion. Not even $1 billion was invested in green technology in the U.S. Well, in a well-functioning financial system, roughly one half of the investment should go to roughly one half of the economy. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And legislators are struggling with this. They're trying to get SBA 7A programs and 504 programs funded. But here's the problem. When you go to the bank to try to get a Small Business Administration loan, guess what? They're not giving any away. Only 3% of banks and credit unions even participate in the SBA program. 97% of the banks do not participate in the program. Even though the federal government is willing to underwrite those loans, they're not participating. Well, there is another way to get America growing again. We don't have to use the banks. We don't have to use the government. Right now, there's about $2 trillion of private equity sitting on the sidelines in America doing nothing but waiting. Actually, it's more like hiding. Yeah. No, I mean, and, okay, hiding from what? I get it. Here's what they're hiding from. They're hiding from zombies. Yeah, no, zombies. Small business zombies. I call them SBZs, small business zombies. Once the profits from oil stocks and fuel futures have been reaped by these so-called green investors, they will be looking for other investments to make their money earn even more money. Okay, a few of them will invest in friends, but healthy humans don't make friends with zombies, okay? They are afraid they will get infected and start oozing poverty out of their orifices. In other words, they're afraid of losing their money. So stick with me now. Here we go. This is zombie economics. You've heard of voodoo economics. This is zombie economics. In the olden days, there was a useful advisor called the broker or money finder. His role was to wade through the zombies on behalf of the investor to find the healthy entrepreneur and lead that entrepreneur safely to the office of the investor. He was rewarded with a small percentage of the deal, much like a real estate broker pockets about 6% of your hard-earned equity when he brings you a buyer for your house. Okay, a walk through your house, two handshakes and a title policy, and boom, he puts $6,000 in his pocket at payday. It's an accepted method for selling homes even to this day, okay? They perform a function. They bring you a buyer for your house. Not so with investing anymore. Brokers and money finders have no investors, okay? They have no contact list of money sources that they can call with a great deal. The dot-com days are over forever, okay? Investors are richer than ever before, but they run very fast and they carry shotguns. They are safely tucked away behind lawyers and layers of protection, and they do not show their money to anyone, especially a zombie. And, just as suspected, the brokers and money finders who once bravely and profitably trolled the zombie alleys got infected. Yeah, now even they cannot find the investors. The only remaining people living in zombie land that have a few corpuscles of health left in them are fed upon by the zombie brokers and money finders with retainers and expense agreements and blah, blah, blah. And you get the story. They look for the healthy entrepreneurs that have a few bucks. They ask for a retainer check and you never see them again. All right. That sounds as dismal as an old scratchy Night of the Living Dead movie where the sun never comes up. But there's reason for hope. The investor is still out there and he's still looking for the entrepreneur to make him a lot of money by using his money to get started and be the next Facebook or the next source of free energy. Okay? And one thing is for certain. The entrepreneur and the investor need each other. And they will find a way to meet and greet. Healthy people will find healthy investors. And the zombies will end up drying up in the desert of scarcity and blowing away. The rain will come. And the sprouts will grow. And fish eggs will hatch. And the harvest will be enormous. Have hope, people. For there are thousands upon thousands of people and other beings out there cheering for you. Most of them cannot help you because they are treading water themselves, but they want you to succeed, okay? The most important thing to remember is that you are on the path and that you are already at your destination. Look at what you have accomplished so far. You have already gone further than most men have dreamed. You can raise the entire planet to a new height of consciousness just because you are trying and choosing and doing something every day that moves your dream forward. Even if it seems like you are sliding backward, you are not. The experience you are gaining is priceless, and it can be earned no other way. There is no classroom where you can learn this struggle. There is no simulator where you get to, you know, feel what it feels like to crash. You crash for real, and you heal, and you get stronger, and you become smarter and more savvy. And when that investor meets you and sees the armor plating that has been forged in the refiner's fire of adversity and criticism and doubt, he will know you are the knight he is looking for. He knows you will be a good steward of his money. Because if the dirt under your fingernails and the sweat stain on the brim of your hat, and when your mortal life has expired, you can smile and cry at the same time because you did it. You walked the path of success. You learned to lead. You learned to care. You provided jobs and goods and services for which people rewarded you with a fair exchange of value. And because of your efforts, a nation was saved. A planet was made better. And I appreciate you so much being here with me tonight on X Squared Radio. You have no idea. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.